remotenesses of the north. So that is where you were until now, Will. In the forest of Anderida, as they used to call it, in the long-gone past. You were there in the beginning of the day, walking through the forest in the snow. There on the empty hillside of the Chilterns. Still there when you had first walked through the doors. That was a symbol. Your first walking. For your birthday as one of the old ones. And there, in that past, is where we left the lady. I wish that I knew where and when we shall see her again. But come she will, when she can. He shrugged, as if to shake away the heaviness again. And now you can go home, for you are in your own world.
And you are in it too, said Will.
Merriman smiled. Back again, with mixed feelings.
Where will you go?
About and round about. I have a place in this present time, just as you do. Go home now, Will. The next stage in the quest depends on the walker, and he will find you. And when his circle is on your belt beside the first, I shall come.
But Will suddenly wanted to clutch at him, to beg him not to go away. His home no longer seemed quite the unassailable fortress it had always been.
You will be all right, Merriman said gently. Take things as they come. Remember that the power protects you. Do nothing rash to draw trouble towards you, and all will be well. And we shall meet soon, I promise you.
All right, Will said uncertainly.
An odd gust of wind eddied round them in the still morning, and gobbets of snow spattered down from the roadside trees. Merriman drew his cloak around him, its bottom edge swirling a pattern in the snow. He gave Will one sharp look of warning and encouragement mixed, pulled his hood forward over his face, and strode off down the road without a word. He disappeared round the bend beside Rook's Wood on the way to Dawson's farm. Will took a deep breath and ran home. The lane was silent in the deep snow and the grey morning. No birds moved or chirped. Nothing stirred anywhere. The house, too, was utterly quiet. He shed his outdoor clothes, went up the silent stairs. On the landing, he stood looking out at the white roofs and fields. No great forest mantled the earth now. The snow was as deep, but it was smooth over the flat fields of the valley, all the way to the curving Thames.
All right, said James, sleepily, from inside his room.
From behind the next door, Robin gave a kind of formless growl and mumbled,
"In a minute. Coming."
Gwen and Mary came stumbling together out of the bedroom they shared, wearing nightdresses, rubbing their eyes.
"There's no need to bellow," Mary said reproachfully to Will.
"Bellow?"
He stared at her.
"Wake up, everyone," she said in a mock shout. "I mean, it's a holiday, for goodness sake."
Will said,
"But I..."
"Never mind," Gwen said. "You can forgive him for wanting to wake us up today. After all, he has a good reason." And she came forward and dropped a quick kiss on the top of his head. "Happy birthday, Will," she said.
The Walker on the Old Way.
"More snow to come, they say,"
said the fat lady with the string bag to the bus conductor. The bus conductor, who was West Indian, shook his head and gave a great glum sigh.
"Crazy weather," he said. "One more winter like this and I'm going back to Port of Spain."
"Cheer up, love," said the fat lady. "You won't see no more like this. 66 years I've lived in the Thames Valley and I never saw it snow like this, not before Christmas, never." 1947, said the man sitting next to her, a thin man with a long pointed nose. "That was a year for snow. My word, it was drifts higher than your head, all down Huntercombe Lane and Marsh Lane and right across the common. Couldn't even cross the common for 2 weeks. I had to get snow ploughs. Oh, that was a year for snow." "But not before Christmas," said the fat lady. "No, it was January," the man nodded mournfully. "Not before Christmas, no."
They might have gone on like this all the way to Maidenhead, and perhaps they did. But Will suddenly noticed
that his bus stop was approaching in the featureless white world outside. He jumped to his feet, clutching at bags and boxes. The conductor punched the bell for him.
"Christmas shopping," he observed.
"Uh-huh. 3, 4, 5.
Will squashed the packages against his chest and hung onto the rail of the lurching bus.
"I've finished it all now," he said. "About time."
"Wish I had," said the conductor. "Christmas Eve tomorrow, too. Frozen blood, that's my problem. Need some warm weather to wake me up."
The bus stopped, and he steadied Will as he stepped off.
"Merry Christmas, man," he said.
They knew one another from Will's bus rides to and from school.
"Merry Christmas," Will said.
On an impulse, he called after him as the bus moved away.
"You'll have some warm weather on Christmas Day."
The conductor grinned a broad, white grin.
"You gonna fix it?"
he called back. Perhaps I could, Will thought, as he tramped along the main road towards Huntercombe Lane. Perhaps I could. The snow was deep, even on the pavements. Few people had been out to tread it down in the last 2 days. For Will, they had been peaceful days, in spite of the memory of what had gone before. He had spent a cheerful birthday, with a family party so boisterous that he had fallen into bed and asleep with scarcely a thought of the dark. After that, there had been a day of snowball fights and improvised toboggans with his brothers in the sloping field behind the house. Grey days, with more snow hanging overhead, but inexplicably not falling yet. Silent days. Hardly a car came down the lane except the vans of the milkman and the baker. And the rooks were quiet, only one or two of them drifting slowly to and fro sometimes over their wood. The animals, Will found, were no longer frightened of him. If anything, they seemed more affectionate than before. Only Rack, the elder of the two collies who liked to sit with his chin resting on Will's knee, would jerk away from him sometimes for no apparent reason, as if propelled by an electric shock. Then he would prowl the room restlessly for a few moments before coming back to gaze inquiringly up into Will's face and make himself comfortable again as before. Will did not know what to make of it. He knew that Merriman would know, but Merriman was out of his reach. The crossed circle at his belt had remained warm to the touch since he had arrived home 2 mornings before. He slipped his hand under his coat now as he walked to check it, and the circle was cold. But he thought that must simply be because he was outdoors, where everything was cold. He had spent most of the afternoon shopping for Christmas presents in Slough, their nearest large town. It was an annual ritual, the day before Christmas Eve being the day when he was certain of having birthday present money from assorted aunts and uncles to spend. This, however, was the first year he had gone alone. He was enjoying it. You could think things out better on your own. The all-important present for Stephen, a book about the Thames, had been bought long before and posted off to Kingston, Jamaica, where his ship was on what was called the Caribbean Station. Will thought it sounded like a train. He decided he must ask his bus conductor friend what Kingston was like, though since the bus conductor came from Trinidad, perhaps he might have stern feelings about other islands. He felt again the small drooping of the spirits that had come in the last 2 days, because this year, for the first time that he could remember, there had been no birthday present from Stephen. And he pushed the disappointment away for the 100th time with the argument that the posts had gone wrong or the ship had suddenly sailed on some urgent mission among the Green Islands. Stephen always remembered. Stephen would have remembered this time if something had not got in the way. Stephen couldn't possibly forget. Ahead of him, the sun was going down, visible for the first time since his birthday morning. It blazed out fat and gold-orange through a gap in the clouds, and all around the snow-silver world glittered with small gold flashes of light. After the grey, slushy streets of the town, everything was beautiful again. Will plodded along, passing garden walls, trees, and then the top of a small, unpaved track, scarcely a road, known as Tramp's Alley, that wandered off from the main road and eventually curled round to join Huntercombe Lane close to the Stantons' house. The children used it as a shortcut sometimes. Will glanced down it now and saw that nobody had been along the path since the snow began. Down there it lay untrodden, smooth and white and inviting, marked only by the picture writing of birds' footprints. Unexplored territory. Will found it irresistible. So he turned down into Tramp's Alley, crunching with relish through the clear, slightly crusted snow, so that fragments of it clung in a fringe to the trousers tucked into his boots. He lost sight of the sun almost at once, cut off by the block of woodland that lay between the little track and the few houses edging the top of Huntercombe Lane. As he stomped through the snow, he clutched his parcels to his chest, counting them again. The knife for Robin, the chamois leather for Paul to clean his flute, the diary for Mary, the bath salts for Gwenny, the super-special felt-tip pens for Max. All his other presents were already bought and wrapped. Christmas was a complicated festival when you were one of nine children. The walk down the alley began quite soon to be less fun than he had expected. Will's ankles ached from the strain of kicking away through the snow. The parcels were awkward to carry. The red golden glow from the sun died away into a dull greyness. He was hungry, and he was cold. Trees loomed high on his right, mostly elms with an occasional beech. At the other side of the track was a stretch of wasteland, transformed by the snow from a messy array of rank weeds and scrub into a moon landscape of white sweeping slopes and shaded hollows. All around him on the snow-covered track, twigs and small branches lay scattered, brought down from the trees by the weight of snow. Just ahead, Will saw a huge branch lying right across his path. He glanced apprehensively upward, wondering how many other dead arms of the great elms were waiting for wind or snow-weight to bring them crashing down. A good time for collecting firewood, he thought, and had a sudden tantalizing image of the leaping fire that had blazed in the fireplace of the great hall, the fire that had changed his world by vanishing at the word of his command and then obediently blazing into life again. As he stumbled along in the cold snow, a sudden, wild, cheerful idea sprang up in his mind out of the thought of that fire, and he paused, grinning to himself. "You gonna fix it?" "Well, no, friend, I probably can't get you a warm Christmas day, really, but I could warm things up a bit here, now." He looked confidently at the dead branch lying before him, and with easy command now of the gift he knew was in him, he said to it softly, mischievously, "Burn." And there on the snow, the fallen arm of the tree burst into flame. Every inch of it, from the thick, rotted base to the smallest twig, blazed with licking yellow fire. There was a hissing sound, and a tall shaft of brilliance rose from the fire like a pillar. No smoke came from the burning, and the flames were steady. Twigs that should have blazed and crackled briefly and then fallen into ash burned continuously, as if fed by other fuel within. Standing there alone, Will felt suddenly small and alarmed. This was no ordinary fire, and not to be controlled by ordinary means. It was not behaving at all in the same way as the fire in the hearth had done. He did not know what to do with it. In panic, he focused his mind on it again and told it to go out, but it burned on steady as before. He knew that he had done something foolish, improper, dangerous, perhaps. Looking up through the pillar of quivering light, he saw high in the grey sky four rooks flapping slowly in a circle. "Oh, Merriman," he thought unhappily, "where are you?" Then he gasped, as someone grabbed him from behind, blocked his kicking feet in a scuffle of snow, and twisted his arms by the wrists behind his back. The parcels scattered in the snow. Will yelled with the pain in his arms. The grip on his wrist slackened at once, as if his attacker were reluctant to do him any real harm, but he was still firmly held.
"Put out the fire,"
said a hoarse voice in his ear urgently.
"I can't," Will said. "Honestly, I've tried, but I can't."
The man cursed and mumbled strangely, and instantly Will knew who it was. His terror fell away like a released weight.
"Walker," he said, "let me go. You don't have to hold me like that."
The grip tightened again at once.
"Oh, no, you don't, boy. I know your tricks. You're the one, all right. I know now. You're an old one. But I don't trust your kind any more than I trust the dark. You're new awake, you are. And let me tell you something you don't know. While you're new awake, you can't do nothing to anyone unless you can see him with your eyes. So you aren't going to see me, that I know."
Will said,
I don't want to do anything to you. There really are some people who can be trusted, you know.
Precious few, the walker said bitterly.
I could shut my eyes if you'd let me go.
Ah,
the old man said.
Will said, you carry the second sign. Give it to me.
There was a silence. He felt the man's hands fall away from his own arms, but he stood where he was and did not turn round.
I have the first sign already, Walker, he said. You know I do. Look, I'm undoing my jacket and I'll pull it back, and you can see the first circle on my belt.
He pulled aside his coat, still without moving his head, and was aware of the walker's hunched form slipping round at his side. The man's breath hissed out through his teeth and a long sigh as he looked, and he turned his head up to Will without caution. In the yellow light from the steadily burning branch, Will saw a face contorted with battling emotions, hope and fear and relief wound tightly together by anguished uncertainty. When the man spoke, his voice was broken and simple as that of a small, sad child.
It's so heavy, he said plaintively. And I've been carrying it for so long. I don't even remember why. Always frightened, always having to run away. If only I could get rid of it. If only I could rest. Oh, if only it was gone. But I daren't risk giving it to the wrong one. I daren't. The things that would happen to me if I did, they're too terrible. They can't be put into words. The old ones can be cruel. Cruel. I think you're the right one, boy. I've been looking for you a long time to give the sign to you. How can I be really sure? How can I be sure you aren't a trick of the dark?
He's been frightened so long, Will thought, that he's forgotten how to stop. How awful to be so absolutely lonely. He doesn't know how to trust me. It's so long since he trusted anyone. He's forgotten how. Look, he said gently. You must know I'm not part of the dark. Think. You saw the rider try to strike me down.
But the old man shook his head miserably, and Will remembered how he had fled shrieking from the clearing the moment the rider had appeared.
Well, if that doesn't help, he said, doesn't the fire tell you?
The fire, almost, the walker said.
He looked at it hopefully. Then his face twisted in recalled alarm.
But the fire, it'll bring them, boy, you know that. The rooks will already be guiding them, and how do I know whether you lit the fire because you're a new awake old one playing games, or as a signal to bring them after me?
He moaned to himself in anguish, and clutched his arms round his shoulders. He was a wretched thing, Will thought pityingly. But somehow he had to be made to understand. Will looked up. There were more rooks circling lazily overhead now, and he could hear them calling harshly to one another. Was the old man right? Were the dark birds messengers of the dark?
Walker, for goodness sake, he said impatiently, you must trust me. If you don't trust someone just once, for long enough to give him the sign, you'll be carrying it forever. Is that what you want?
The old tramp wailed and muttered, staring at him from mad little eyes. He seemed caught in his centuries of suspicion like a fly in a web. But the fly still has wings that can break the web, give him the strength to flap them just once. Driven by some unfamiliar part of his mind, without quite knowing what he was doing, Will gripped the iron circle on his belt, and he stood up as straight and tall as he could and pointed at the walker and called out,
"The last of the old ones has come, Walker, and it is time. The moment for giving the sign is now, now or never. Think only of that. No other chance will come. Now, Walker, unless you would carry it forever, obey the old ones now. Now!"
It was as if the word released a spring. In an instant, all the fear and suspicion in the twisted old face relaxed into childish obedience. With a smile of almost foolish eagerness, the walker fumbled with a broad leather strap that he wore diagonally across his chest,
and he pulled from it a quartered circle identical with the one that Will wore on his belt, but gleaming with the dull brown-gold sheen of bronze. He put it into Will's hands, and gave a high, cackling little laugh of astonished glee. The yellow flaming branch on the snow before them blazed suddenly brighter, and went out. The branch lay just as it had when Will first came down the alley, grey, uncharred, cold, as if no part of it had ever been touched by spark or flame. Clutching the bronze circle, Will stared down at the rough-barked wood lying there on unmarked snow. Now that its light was gone, the day seemed suddenly much more murky, full of shadows, and he realized with a shock how little of the afternoon was left. It was late. He must go. And then a clear voice said, out of the shadows ahead,
"Hello, Will Stanton."
The walker squealed in terror, a thin, ugly sound. Will slipped the bronze circle quickly into his pocket and stepped stiffly forward. Then he almost sat down on the snow in relief as he saw that the newcomer was only Maggie Barnes, the dairy girl from Dawson's Farm. Nothing sinister about Maggie, Max's apple-cheeked admirer. Her dumpling form was all muffled up in coat and boots and scarf. She was carrying a covered basket and heading down towards the main road. She beamed at Will, then peered accusingly at the walker.
"Why," she said, in her round Buckinghamshire voice, "'tis that old tramp that's been hanging around this past fortnight. Farmer said he wanted to see the back of you, old man. He been bothering you, young Will? I bet he has now."
She glared at the walker, who shrank sullenly into his dirty cape-like coat.
"Oh, no," Will said. "I was just running down from the bus from Slough, and I bumped into him. Really bumped. Dropped all my Christmas shopping," he added hastily,
and bent to collect his parcels and packages that still lay scattered on the snow. The walker sniffed, hunched himself deeper inside his coat, and made to shuffle off past Maggie up the track. But as he drew level with her, he stopped abruptly, jerking back as if he had struck some invisible barrier. He opened his mouth, but no sound came. Will straightened up slowly, watching, his arms full of bundles. A dreadful sense of misgiving began to creep over him, like the chill of a cold breeze. Maggie Barnes said amiably,
"Long time since the last bus from Slough, young Will. Fact, I'm just off to catch the next one. You always take half an hour to do that 5-minute walk from the bus stop, Will Stanton." "I don't see that it's any business of yours how long I take about anything," Will said.
He was watching the frozen walker, and some very confused images were turning about in his head.
"Manners, manners," said Maggie. "Such a nicely brought-up little boy as you, too."
Her eyes were very bright, peering at Will from the scarf-wrapped head.
"Well, goodbye, Maggie," said Will. "I've got to get home. Tea's past ready." "Trouble with nasty, dirty tramps, like this one you just bumped into but who isn't bothering you," Maggie Barnes said softly without moving. "Trouble with them is, they steal things. And this one stole something the other day from the farm, young Will, something belonging to me. An ornament. A big goldeny-brown-coloured kind of ornament, circle-shaped, that I wore on a chain round my neck. And I want it back. Now."
The last word flicked out viciously, and then she was all soft sweetness again, as if her gentle voice had never changed.
"I want it back, I do. And I do think he might just have slipped it in your pocket when you weren't looking, when you bumped into him. If he saw me coming, that is, as he might well have done in the light of that funny little bonfire I saw burning up here just now. What do you think of all that, young Will Stanton, eh?"
Will swallowed. The hair was prickling upright on the back of his neck as he listened to her. There she stood, looking just the same as ever, the rosy-cheeked, uncomplicated farm girl who ran Dawson's milking machine and reared the smallest calves. And yet the mind out of which these words were coming could be nothing but the mind of the dark. Had they stolen Maggie? Or had Maggie always been one of them? If she had, what else could she do? He stood facing her, one hand clutching his parcels, one hand sliding cautiously into his pocket. The bronze sign was cold, cold to his touch. He summoned up all the power of thought that he could find to drive her away, and still she stood there, smiling coldly at him. He conjured her to leave by all the names of power that he could remember Merriman using, by the lady, by the circle, by the signs. But he knew he did not have the right things to say. And Maggie laughed aloud and moved deliberately forward, looking into his face. And Will found that he could not move a muscle. He was caught, frozen, just like the walker, fixed, immobile, in a position he could not alter by so much as an inch. He glared furiously at Maggie Barnes in her smooth red scarf and demure black coat as she calmly slipped her hand past his into his coat pocket and drew out the bronze sign. She held it in front of his face and then rapidly unbuttoned his coat, flicked his belt away from him, and threaded the bronze circle on it to stand next to the iron.
"Hold up your trousers, Will Stanton," she said mockingly. "Oh, dear, now you can't, can you? But then you don't really wear that belt to keep up your trousers, do you? You wear it to keep this little decoration safe."
Will noticed that she held the two signs as lightly as possible and winced when she had to touch them with any firmness. The cold that was beating out of them must surely be burning her to the bone. He watched in utter despair. There was nothing he could do. All his effort and questing was coming to an end before it had even properly begun, and there was nothing he could do. He wanted both to shout with rage and to weep. And then, deep down, something stirred in his mind. Some detail of memory flickered, but he could not catch it. He remembered it only at the moment when fresh-faced Maggie Barnes held up his belt before him with the first and second circle threaded there together, dull iron and gleaming bronze side by side. Staring greedily at the two circles, Maggie broke into a low gurgle of sneering laughter that sounded the more evil for the rosy openness of the face from which it came. And Will remembered.
"When his circle is on your belt beside the first, I shall come."
At that same moment, fire leapt up out of the fallen elm tree branch that Will had briefly lighted before, and flames cracked down from nowhere in a circle of searing white light all around Maggie Barnes, a circle of light higher than her head. She crouched down suddenly on the snow, cringing, her mouth slack with fear. The belt with the two linked signs dropped out of her limp hand. And Merriman was there, tall in the long dark cloak, his face hidden in shadow by the enveloping hood. He was there at the side of the road, just beyond the flaring circle and the cowering girl.
"Take her from this road," he said in a clear, loud voice.
And the blazing circle of light moved slowly to one side, forcing the girl Maggie to stumble with it, until it hovered on the rough ground next to the road. Then, with an abrupt crackling sound, it was gone, and Will saw instead a great barrier of light spring up on either side of the road, edging it on both sides with leaping fire, stretching far into the distance in both directions, a great deal further than the length of the track that Will knew as Tramp's Alley. He stared at it, a little frightened. Out in the dimness he could see Maggie Barnes grovelling wretchedly in the snow, her arms shielding her eyes from the light. But he and Merriman and the walker stood in a great endless tunnel of cold white flame. Will bent and picked up his belt, and in a kind of relieved greeting, he grasped the two signs in his hands, iron in his left hand, bronze in his right. Merriman came to his side, raised his right arm so that the cloak swept down from it like the wing of some great bird, and pointed one long finger at the girl. He called out a long, strange name that Will had never heard before and could not keep in his mind, and the girl Maggie wailed aloud. Merriman said, with scorn death-cold in his voice,
"Go back, and tell them that the signs are beyond their touching, and if you would remain unharmed, do not try again to work your will while you stand on one of our ways. For the old roads awakened, and their power is alive again, and this time they will have no pity and no remorse."
He called out the strange name again, and the flames edging the road leapt higher, and the girl screamed high and shrill, as if she were in great pain. Then she scuffled away across the snowy field like a small hunched animal. Merriman looked down at Will.
Remember the two things that saved you, he said, the light glinting now on his beaked nose and deep-set eyes under the shadowing hood. First, I knew her real name. The only way to disarm one of the creatures of the dark is to call him or her by his real name. Names that they keep very secret. Then, as well as the name, there was the road. Do you know the name of this track?
Tramp's Alley, Will said automatically.
That is not a real name,
Merriman said with distaste.
Well, no. Mum won't ever use it, and we're not supposed to. It's ugly, she says. But nobody else I know ever calls it anything else. I'd feel silly if I called it Old Way.
Will stopped suddenly, hearing and tasting the name properly for the first time in his life. He said slowly,
If I called it by its real name, Old Way Lane.
You would feel silly, said Merriman grimly. But the name that would make you feel silly has helped to save your life. Old Way Lane. Yes, and it was not named for some distant Mr. Oldway. The name simply tells you what the road is, as the names of roads and places in old lands very often do, if only men would pay them more attention. It was lucky for you that you were standing on one of the old ways, trodden by the old ones, for some 3,000 years when you played your little game with fire, Will Stanton. If you had been anywhere else, in your state of untrained power, you would have made yourself so vulnerable that all the things of the dark that are in this land would have been drawn towards you, as the witch girl was drawn by the birds. Look hard at this road now, boy, and do not call it by vulgar names again.
Will swallowed and stared at the flame-edged way stretching into the distance like some noble road of the sun, and on a sudden wild impulse he made it a clumsy little bow, bending from the waist as well as his armful of packages would let him. The flames leapt again and curved inward, almost as if they were bowing in return. Then they went out.
"Well done," said Merriman with surprise and a touch of amusement.
Will said,
I will never, never again do anything with the power, unless there is a reason. I promise. By the lady and the old world. But,
he could not resist it.
Merriman, it was my fire that brought the walker to me, wasn't it? And the walker had the sign.
The walker was waiting for you, stupid boy, said Merriman irritably.
I told you that he would find you, and you did not remember. Remember now. In this our magic, every smallest word has a weight and a meaning. Every word that I say to you, or that any other old one may say. The walker. He had been waiting for you to be born, and to stand alone with him and command the sign from him for time past your imagining. You did that well, I will say. It was a problem to bring him to the point of giving up the sign when the time came. Poor soul. He betrayed the old ones once, long ago, and this was his doom.
His voice softened a little.
It has been a hard age for him, the carrying of the second sign. He has one more part in our work, before he may have rest, if he chooses. But that is not yet.
They both looked at the motionless figure of the walker, still standing caught in frozen movement at the side of the road as Maggie Barnes had left him.
That's an awfully uncomfortable position, Will said.
He feels nothing, said Merriman. Not a muscle will even grow stiff. Some small powers the old ones and the people of the dark have in common, and one of them is this catching a man out of time for as long as is necessary, or in the case of the dark, for as long as they find it amusing.
He pointed a finger at the immobile, shapeless form and spoke some soft, rapid words that Will did not hear, and the walker relaxed into life like a figure in a moving film that has been stopped and then started again. Staring wide-eyed, he looked at Merriman and opened his mouth and made a curious, dry, speechless sound.
Go,
Merriman said. The old man cringed away, clasping his flapping garments around him, and shambled off at a half-run up the narrow path. Watching him as he went, Will blinked, then peered hard, then rubbed his eyes. For the walker seemed to be fading, growing strangely thinner, so that you could see the trees through his body. Then all at once he was gone, like a star blotted out by a cloud. Merriman said,
"My doing, not his own. He deserves peace for a while, I think, in another place than this. That is the power of the old ways, Will. You would have used the trick to escape from the witch girl very easily if you had known how. You will learn that, and the proper names, and much else very soon now."
Will said curiously,
"What is your proper name?"
The dark eyes glinted at him from inside the hood.
"Merriman Lyon. I told you when we met."
"But I think that if that had really been your proper name, as an old one, you would not have told me it," Will said. "At any rate, not out loud."
"You are learning already," Merriman said cheerfully. "Come, it grows dark."
They set off together down the lane. Will trotted beside the striding, cloaked figure, clutching his bags and boxes. They spoke little, but Merriman's hand was always there to catch him if he stumbled at any hollow or drift. As they came out at the far curve of the track into the greater breadth of Huntercombe Lane, Will saw his brother Max walking briskly towards them.
"Look, there's Max."
"Yes," Merriman said.
Max called, gaily waving, and then he was close.
"I was just coming to meet you off this bus," he said. "Mama's getting in a bit of a tiz because her baby boy was late."
"Oh, for goodness sake," Will said.
"Why were you coming that way?"
Max waved in the direction of Tramp's Alley.
"We were just..."
Will began, and as he turned his head to include Merriman in the remark, he stopped so abruptly that he bit his tongue. Merriman was gone. In the snow where he had been standing a moment before, no mark of any kind was left. And as Will looked back the way they had walked across Huntercombe Lane and down the top curve of the smaller track, he could see only one line of footprints. His own. He thought he heard a faint, silvery music somewhere in the air, but even as he raised his head to listen, it too was gone. Part 2. The Learning. Christmas Eve. Christmas Eve. It was the day when the delight of Christmas really took fire in the Stanton family. Hints and glimmerings and promises of special things which had flashed in and out of life for weeks before now suddenly blossomed into a constant glad expectancy. The house was full of wonderful baking smells from the kitchen, in a corner of which Gwen could be found putting the final touches to the icing of the Christmas cake. Her mother had made the cake 3 weeks before, the Christmas pudding 3 months before that. Ageless, familiar Christmas music permeated the house whenever anyone turned on the radio. The television set was never turned on at all. It had become, for this season, an irrelevance. For Will, the day brought itself into natural focus very early. Straight after breakfast, an even more haphazard affair than usual, there was the double ritual of the Yule log and the Christmas tree. Mr. Stanton was finishing the last piece of toast. Will and James stood on either side of him at the breakfast table, fidgeting. Their father held a crust, forgotten, in one hand, as he pored over the sports page of the newspaper. Will, too, was passionately interested in the fortunes of Chelsea Football Club, but not on Christmas Eve morning.
"Would you like some more toast, Dad?"
he said loudly.
"Mm," said Mr. Stanton.
"Nah."
James said,
"Have you had enough tea, Dad?"
Mr. Stanton looked up, turned his round, mild-eyed head from one to the other of them, and laughed. He put down the paper, drained his teacup, and crammed the piece of toast into his mouth.
"Come on, then,"
he said indistinctly, taking each of them by an ear. They howled happily and ran for boots and jackets and scarves. Down the road with the handcart they went, Will, James, Mr. Stanton, and tall Max, bigger than his father, bigger than anyone, with his long dark hair jutting in a comical fringe out of a disreputable old cap. What would Maggie Barnes think of that, Will wondered cheerfully, when she peeped roguishly as usual round the kitchen curtain to catch Max's eye.
And then in the same instant he remembered about Maggie Barnes, and he thought in a rush of alarm,
Farmer Dawson is one of the old ones. He must be warned about her.
And he was distraught that he had not thought of it before. They stopped in Dawson's yard, old George Smith coming out to meet them with his gaping grin. The going had been easier along the road that morning since a plough had been through, but everywhere the snow still lay unmoving in a constant grey, windless cold.
"Got you a treat to beat all," old George called joyfully. "Straight as a mast, like farmers. Both royal trees again, I reckon."
"Royal as they come," said Mr. Dawson, pulling his coat tight round him as he came out. He meant it, literally, Will knew. Every year a number of Christmas trees were sold from the Crown Plantations round Windsor Castle, and several came back in the Dawson farm lorry to the village.
"Morning, Frank," said Mr. Stanton.
"Morning, Roger," said Farmer Dawson, and beamed at the boys.
"Hey, lads, round the back with that cart."
His eyes slid impersonally over Will, without so much as a flicker of notice. But Will had deliberately left his jacket swinging open in such a way that it was plain there were now two crossed circle signs on his belt, not one.
"Good to see you looking so lively," said Mr.
Dawson breezily to them all, as they heaved the handcart round behind the barn. And his hand rested briefly on Will's shoulder with a faint pressure that told him Farmer Dawson had a good idea of what had been happening in the last few days. He thought of Maggie Barnes and searched hastily for words to frame a warning.
"Where's your girlfriend, Max?" he said carefully, loud and clear.
"Girlfriend?" said Max indignantly. Being deeply involved with a blonde-tressed student at his London art school from whom enormous blue enveloped letters arrived in the post every day, he was totally uninterested in all local girls.
"Ho, ho, ho," said Will, trying hard. "You know!"
Fortunately, James was fond of this kind of thing and joined in with enthusiasm.
"Maggie, Maggie, Maggie!" he chanted gaily. "Oh, Maggie the dairymaid's sweet on Maxie the great artist. Ooh, ooh!"
Max punched him in the ribs and he lapsed into snorting giggles.
"Young Maggie's had to leave us," Mr. Dawson said coolly. "Illness in the family. Needed at home. She packed up and went early this morning. Sorry to disappoint you, Max."
"I'm not disappointed," said Max, turning scarlet. "It's just these stupid little... Ooh," sang James, dancing about out of arm's length.
"Ooh, poor Maxie lost his Maggie."
Will said nothing. He was satisfied. The tall fir tree, its branches tied down with bands of hairy white string, was loaded onto the handcart, and with it the gnarled old root of a beech tree that Farmer Dawson had cut down earlier that year, split in half, and put aside to make yule logs for himself and the Stantons. It had to be the root of a tree, not a branch, Will knew, though nobody had ever explained why. At home, they would put the log on the fire tonight in the big brick fireplace in the living room, and it would burn slowly all the evening until they went to bed. Somewhere stored away was a piece of last year's yule log, saved to be used as kindling for its successor.
"Here,"
old George said, appearing suddenly at Will's side as they all pushed the cart out of the gate.
"You should have some of this."
He thrust forward a great bunch of holly, heavy with berries.
"Very good of you, George," said Mr. Stanton. "But we do have that big holly tree by the front door, you know. If you know anyone who hasn't..."
"Oh, no, you take it,"
the old man wagged his finger.
"Not half so many berries on that bush of yours. Particular holly, this is."
He laid it carefully in the cart, then quickly broke off a sprig and slipped it into the top buttonhole of Will's coat.
"And good protection against the dark,"
the old voice said low in Will's ear,
"if pinned over the window and over the door."
Then the pink-gummed grin split his creased brown face in a squawk of ancient laughter, and the old one was old George again, waving them away.
"Happy Christmas!"
"Happy Christmas, George!"
When they carried the tree ceremonially through the front door, the twins seized it with crossboards and screwdrivers to give it a base. At the other end of the room, Mary and Barbara sat in a rustling sea of coloured paper, cutting it into strips, red, yellow, blue, green, and gluing them into interlocked circles for paper chains.
"You should have done those yesterday," Will said. "They'll need time to dry."
"You should have done them yesterday," Mary said resentfully, tossing back her long hair. "It's supposed to be the youngest's job."
"I cut up lots of strips the other day,"
Will said.
We used those up hours ago. I did cut them all the same.
Besides, Barbara said peaceably, he was Christmas shopping yesterday, so you'd better shut up, Mary, or he might decide to take your present back.
Mary muttered, but subsided, and Will half-heartedly stuck a few paper chains together. But he kept an eye on the doorway, and when he saw his father and James appear with their arms full of old cardboard boxes, he slipped quietly away after them. Nothing could keep him from the decorating of the Christmas tree. Out of the boxes came all the familiar decorations that would turn the life of the family into a festival for 12 nights and days. The golden-haired figure for the top of the tree, the strings of jewel-coloured lights. Then there were the fragile glass Christmas tree balls, lovingly preserved for years. Half-spheres walled like red and gold-green seashells. Slender glass spears, spiderwebs of silvery glass threads and beads. On the dark limbs of the tree they hung and gently turned, shimmering. There were other treasures then, little gold stars and circles of plaited straw, light swinging silver paper bells. Next, a medley of decorations made by assorted Stanton children, ranging from Will's infant pipe cleaner reindeer to a beautiful filigree cross that Max had fashioned out of copper wire in his first year at art school. Then there were strings of tinsel to be draped across any space, and then the box was empty. But not quite empty. Rifling his fingers gingerly through the crumpled handfuls of packing paper, in an old cardboard container nearly as tall as himself, Will found a small, flat box not much larger than his hand. It rattled.
"What's this?"
he said curiously, trying to open the lid.
"Good heavens,"
said Mrs. Stanton from her central armchair.
"Let me see that a moment, love. Is it? Yes, it is. Was it in the big box? Oh, I thought we'd lost it years ago. Just look at this, Roger. See what your youngest son's found. It's Frank Dawson's box of letters."
She pressed a catch on the lid of the box so that it flicked up, and Will saw inside a number of ornate little carvings done in some light wood that he could not name. Mrs. Stanton held one up. A curved letter S, with the beautifully detailed head and scaly body of a snake, twirling on an almost invisible thread. Then another, an arched M, with peaks like the twin spires of a fairy cathedral. The carvings were so delicate that it was quite impossible to see where they joined the threads from which they hung. Mr. Stanton came down from the stepladder and poked one gentle finger into the box.
"Well, well," he said. "Clever old Will." "I've never seen them before," said Will. "Well, you have, really," his mother said, "but so long ago that you wouldn't remember. They disappeared years and years ago. Fancy them being at the bottom of that old box all the time." "But what are they?"
"Christmas tree ornaments, of course," Mary said, peering over her mother's shoulder.
"Farmer Dawson made them for us," Mrs. Stanton said. "Beautifully carved, as you see, and exactly as old as the family. On our first Christmas Day in this house, Frank made an R for Roger," she fished it out, "and an A for me."
Mr. Stanton pulled out two letters which both hung together from the same thread.
"Robin and Paul. This pair came a bit later than usual. We haven't been expecting twins. Really, Frank was awfully good. I wonder if he has time for anything like this now."
Mrs. Stanton was still turning the small wooden curlicues in her thin, strong fingers.
"M for Max and M for Mary.
Frank was very cross with us for having a repeat, I remember."
"Oh, Roger," she said, her voice suddenly softening. "Look at this one."
Will stood beside his father to look. It was a letter T, carved like an exquisite little tree spreading two branches wide.
"T," he said, "but none of us begins with T." "That was Tom," his mother said. "I don't really know why I've never spoken to you younger ones about Tom. It was just so long ago. Tom was your little brother, who died. He had something wrong with his lungs, a disease some new babies get, and he only lived for 3 days after he was born. Frank had the initial already carved for him, because it was our first baby and we had two names chosen. Tom if it was a boy, Tess if it was a girl." A voice sounded slightly muffled,
and Will suddenly regretted finding the letters. He patted her shoulder awkwardly.
"Never mind, Mum," he said.
"Oh, gracious," said Mrs. Stanton briskly. "I'm not sad, love. It was a very long while ago. Tom would have been a grown-up man by now, older than Stephen.
After all," she gave a comical look round the room, cluttered with people and boxes,
"a brood of nine should be enough for any woman."
"You can say that again," said Mr. Stanton.
"Comes of having farming forebears, Mum," said Paul. "They believed in large families, lots of free labour."
"Speaking of free labour," said his father, "where have James and Max gone?"
"Fetching the other boxes."
"Good Lord, such initiative."
"Christmas spirit," said Robin from the stepladder. "Good Christian men rejoice and all that. Why doesn't someone turn some music on?"
Barbara, sitting on the floor beside her mother, took the little carved wooden tea from her hand and added it to a row she had made on the carpet of every initial in order.
"Tom, Steve, Max, Gwen, Robin and Paul, me, Mary, James," she said.
"But where's the W for Will? Will's was there with all the rest in the box."
"It wasn't a W, actually, if you remember," said Mr. Stanton. "It was a kind of pattern. I dare say Frank had got tired of doing initials by then." He grinned at Will.
"But it's not here," Barbara said.
She held the box upside down, then shook it. Then she looked at her youngest brother solemnly.
"Will," she said, "you don't exist."
But Will was feeling a growing uneasiness that seemed to come from some very deep, far-away part of his mind.
"You said it was a pattern, not a W," he said casually. "What sort of pattern, Dad?"
"A mandala, as I recall," said Mr. Stanton.
"A what?"
His father chuckled.
"Pay no attention, I was only showing off. I don't imagine Frank would have called it that. A mandala is a very ancient kind of symbol, dating back to sun worship and that kind of thing. Any pattern made of a circle with lines radiating outward or inward. Your little Christmas ornament was just a simple one. A circle with a star inside. Or a cross. A cross, I think it was."
"I can't think why it isn't there with the rest," said Mrs. Stanton.
But Will could. If there was power in knowing the proper names of the people of the dark, perhaps the dark could in its turn work magic over others by using some sign that was a symbol of a name, like a carved initial. Perhaps someone had taken his own sign in order to try to get power over him that way. And perhaps, indeed, this was why Farmer Dawson had carved him not an initial, but a symbol that nobody of the dark could use. They had stolen it anyway, to try. A little while later, Will slipped away from the tree decorating and went upstairs and pinned a sprig of holly over the door and each of the windows of his room. He tucked a piece into the newly mended catch of the skylight as well. Then he did the same for the windows of James's room, which he would share for Christmas Eve, and came downstairs and fixed a small bunch neatly over the front and back doors of the house. He would have done the same to all the windows, too, if Gwen hadn't crossed the hall and noticed what he was doing.
"Oh, Will," she said, "not everywhere. Put it all along the mantelpiece or somewhere, so it's controllable. I mean, otherwise we shall have holly berries underfoot every time anyone draws the curtains."
A typical female attitude, Will thought in disgust. But he was not inclined to draw attention to his holly by making any great protest. In any case, he reflected as he tried to arrange the holly artistically over the mantel, up here it would be a protection against the only entry into the house that he had forgotten about. Having left his Father Christmas days behind, he had not thought about the chimney. The house was glowing now with light and colour and excitement. Christmas Eve was almost accomplished. But last of all, there came the carol singing. After tea that day, when the Christmas lights had been turned on and when the last rustling scuttlings of present wrappings were ending, Mr. Stanton stretched back in his battered leather armchair, took out his pipe, and beamed pontifically at them all.
"Well," he said, "who's going on the trek this year?"
"Me," said James.
"Me,"
said Will.
"Barbara and I," said Mary.
"Paul, of course," said Will.
His brother's flute case was already on the kitchen table.
"I don't know whether I shall," Robin said.
Yes, you will, said Paul. No good without a baritone.
Oh, all right, said his twin begrudgingly. This brief exchange had been repeated annually now for 3 years. Being large, mechanically minded, and an excellent footballer, Robin felt it was not quite proper for him to show eagerness for any activity as ladylike as carol singing. In fact, he was genuinely devoted to music like the rest of them, and had a pleasant, dark brown voice.
Too busy, Gwen said. Sorry.
What she means is, said Mary from a safe distance, that she has to wash her hair in case Johnny Penn might come round.
What do you mean, might, said Max from the armchair next to his father's. Gwen made a terrible face at him.
Well, she demanded, and what about you going carolling?
Even busier than you, Max said lazily. Sorry.
And what he means is, said Mary, now hovering beside the door, that he has to sit up in his room and write another enormous long letter to his blonde bird in Southampton.
Max pulled off one of his slippers to hurl, but she was gone.
Bird, said his father, whatever will the word be next?
Good grief, Dad,
James looked at him in horror.
You really do live in the Stone Age. Girls have been birds since the year one. Just about as much brains as birds, too, if you ask me.
Some real birds have quite a lot of brains,
Will said reflectively.
Don't you think?
But the episode of the rooks had been so effectively removed from James's mind that he took no notice. The words bounced off.
Off you all go, said Mrs. Stanton. Boots, stick coats, and back by 8:30.
8:30, Robin said, if we give Miss Bell 3 carols and Miss Graythorne asks us all in for punch.
Well, 9:30 at the very outside, she said.
It was very dark by the time they left. The sky had not cleared, and no moon nor even a single star glimmered through the black night. The lantern that Robin carried on a pole cast a glittering circle of light on the snow, but each of them had a candle in one coat pocket just the same. When they reached the manor, old Miss Graythorne would insist on their coming in and standing in her great stone-floored entrance hall with all the lights turned out, each holding up a lighted candle while they sang. The air was freezing, and their breath clouded out thick and white. Now and then a stray snowflake drifted down from the sky, and Will thought of the fat lady in the bus and her predictions. Barbara and Mary were chattering away as cozily as if they were sitting at home. But behind the chatter, the footsteps of all the group rang out cold and hard on the snow-caked road. Will was happy, snug in the thought of Christmas and the pleasure of carol singing. He walked along in a contented, dreamy state, clutching the big collecting box they carried in aid of Huntercombe's small, ancient, famous, and rapidly crumbling Saxon church. Then, there ahead of them was Dawson's farm, with a large bunch of the many-berried holly nailed above the back door, and the carol singing had begun. On through the village they sang, Noel for the rector, God rest ye merry gentlemen, for jolly Mr. Hutton, the enormous businessman in the new mock Tudor house at the end of the village, who always looked as though he were resting very merry indeed. Once in Royal David's City for Mrs. Pettigrew, the widowed postmistress, who dyed her hair with tea leaves and kept a small limp dog, which looked like a skein of grey wool. They sang Adeste Fidelis in Latin and Les Anges dans nos campagnes in French for tiny Miss Bell, the retired village schoolmistress, who had taught every one of them how to read and write, add and subtract, talk and think, before they went on to other schools elsewhere. And little Miss Bell said huskily,
Beautiful. Beautiful.
Put some coins that they knew she could not afford into the collecting box, gave each of them a hug, and
Merry Christmas, Merry Christmas.
They were off to the next house on the list. There were 4 or 5 more, one of them the home of lugubrious Mrs. Horniman, who did for their mother once a week and had been born and bred in the East End of London until a bomb had blown her house to bits 30 years before. She had always given them a silver sixpence each, and so she still did, coolly disregarding changes in the currency.
"Wouldn't be Christmas without sixpences," Mrs. Horniman said. "I laid a good stock in before we got landed with all them decimals, so I did. So I can go on every Christmas just the way I used to, me ducks, and I reckon my stock'll see me out until I'm deep in me grave and you're singing to someone else at this here door. Merry Christmas."
And then it was the manor, the last stop before home. "Here we come a-wassailing among the leaves so green. Here we come a-wandering, so fair to be seen."
They always began with the old wassail song for Miss Greythorne, and this year the bit about the green leaves, Will reflected, was even more inappropriate than usual. The carol bounded its way along, and for the last verse Will and James soared up into the high-pealing descant that they did not always